Hey there, Freedom Fighters. My name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy.com. It is, of course, home of the ambitious upstart, the place where I interview entrepreneurs about how they built their businesses. And a few months ago, I was in Las Vegas and I met this guy, Steven, who's been listening to Mixergy for a long time. And he walks up to me and says, Andrew, you should interview the founder of my company. And I said, what's the company? And he said, Pigeonly. And I go, I know Pigeonly. I know them because I heard this great piece on NPR about them. And then I started reading all over about how they got funding from Y Combinator. The story is incredibly exciting and captivating. This entrepreneur went to prison, learned business in prison, came up with an idea based on his experience and frustrations from prison, launched the business, grew it, got revenue, got funding, unbelievable success story. I'm so excited to have him on here. His name is Frederick Hudson. He is the co-founder of Pigeonly. It's a startup focused on serving the U.S. prison population. They do things like allow prisoners to get photos from their loved ones or make phone calls to their loved ones. Those kind of services are what they offer. We're going to talk about how he did this and the incredible things that that he learned in prison. And this interview is sponsored by two great companies. The first will help you hire your first and last and lots of developers, called TopTal, and the second one will help you schedule meetings with people who will actually show up to those meetings. It's called Acuity Scheduling. I'll tell you more about both of them later. First, Frederick, good to have you here.
Thank you.
Is it wrong that I kind of admire the thing that you did that got you to prison?
No, I mean, I think I was a little bit ahead of my time.
Yeah.
Had I had the level of marijuana distribution that I had in 2005 and 2016, you know, I might have been one of the top sellers or might have gotten an award.
You know, right. Things. You would have gotten lots of funding. So yeah. what did you do that got you into prison?
Yeah, so what I was doing is I started when I was like, I want to say 19, distribution marijuana. So basically moving marijuana from Nogales, Mexico through Tucson, Arizona.
At 19, from Mexico to Tucson, Arizona?
To Tucson,
that was
Arizona.
The first thing that you did?
Yes.
Wow, okay.
And then from Arizona to Las Vegas, and then from Las Vegas down to its destination in middle and central Florida, you know, Tampa, St. Petersburg, you know, that area.
How did you do that? What was the process? How'd you do it?
Yeah. So, you know, it was really just leveraging UPS, FedEx, DHL. And, you know, our process was, instead of, you know, physically driving it, you know, we would ship it in along the main carriers. And then we would basically have, you know, shipping routes and people on the payroll that was on particular shipping routes to basically deliver the boxes to addresses that we would designate or to people that we would designate at this final destination.
How did you work this out yourself? Know who to give money to?
How I got started was, you know, my brain always starts to lean towards a way to solve a problem. And, you know, my buddies who were doing this prior too, they were actually physically driving marijuana from Texas to Florida. And it was just insanely risky. It was insanely difficult. So, you know, when I started looking, I was like, why not just leverage the logistics system that's already in place with the shipping centers and just use that? They already have it down. Why don't we just use those? And then that's how it started. So just really started packing it and shipping it. And then, you know, inverted, I started learning all the shipping routes. I should have learned what shipping routes to avoid, what days the DA would be in shipping centers, what days they would not. And I just got very good at it.
How could you figure out which ones to avoid?
I just started learning to watch the tracking information. And there's details in tracking information as you look at the packages path that gives you hints to what could be going on at that given facility.
Like what? What could be going on?
So, for example, if you see a package that would get in at 7:30 a.m. versus 6:45 a.m., you know, it was a sign that there could have been something that went wrong. So now I would also look, was there weather issues? Were there other issues? Or could this be something that could be a sign that when that box was delivered to Tampa, don't touch it?
So when we talk about money in the startup world, we're talking about numbers on an iPhone or in a bank account. You actually had to have seen the cash. Do you remember like the most cash you saw in person?
At one time, probably over the course of doing this, you know, probably saw, you know, at least millions, you know,
millions of dollars in cash.
Yeah. Because, you know, when you
think
about
most at one time,
cash, probably about $500,000 in cash at one time.
And did you know at the time that you were a real businessman and entrepreneur and this was just your path? No.
No, I had no concept of, you don't start trying to be the biggest drug dealer. You don't start trying to do any of that. Really, it just starts growing. So you start, I started, buying one pound of marijuana for $500. And it just kind of grew from there. So you don't, by the time you look up, you're knee deep into something and you don't even realize it. And it just becomes a way of life and you have no concept. You know, now in business, and I see, how much work it is to get to $1 million in revenue, how much work it is to get to $2 million in revenue. Mm-hmm. It's completely different. Then it was like nothing. So.
So this is now a business like that is fully legitimate. I actually was talking with Tim Moxie, one of my past interviewees. He created Noon, those little tablets that you see in grocery stores that you put into water and it turns it into a Gatorade-like drink that's actually healthier. I asked him, or he told me what he was up to. He's creating edibles and selling edibles, like all fully legit. I was at Justin Kahn's place, the co-founder of Twitch, which he sold to Amazon. I asked this guy, Nick, at his place, what do you do? He said, I help manage investments. I said, what are you looking at now? And he started telling me about his most exciting investment was in a marijuana company. So these guys are building these businesses legitimately. You were building it too. And when you did it, there was one day where I guess it was the Drug Enforcement Agency, the DEA, came in. Do you remember that day?
Yeah, vividly. You'll never forget a day like that. I mean, so I was at Winnie's, my shipping center. So one of the things that, I started doing as we started getting bigger, it became less and less, it became more and more difficult to be able to drop these packages off, these marijuana packages off at, existing shipping centers. So I started buying my own. So I had one shipping center in Las Vegas that allowed me to move more volume through that shipper because I owned it. And one day I was outside talking to one of our customers and about three cars pulled up and about 11 DA agents all rushed and I already knew what it was about. So, where do you want me to stand? Where do you want to put my hands? Basically?
I'd be so scared to death. Were you scared in that moment?
I don't know if fear would be the emotion. I think the emotion would be the first thing I was thinking about. Where did I slip up? What did I do wrong? And just started replaying everything in my head. To see, at what point did this start to go this direction that I did not see already? I think I was probably disappointed that I didn't see it.
I see. But to you, this is a chess match that you lost, and you're wondering what move was the wrong one.
Right, I made a wrong move somewhere, and someone took the queen.
The scary part I heard was you were on an airplane, shackled to your seat afterwards, and there was a guy next to you. Do you remember the guy I'm talking about who was just really in a more than a shackle? He had a face mask.
Yeah. That was a crazy thing because, when you're on, first of all, I didn't even know Kanye was real. I saw the movie with Nicolas Cage. I didn't know it was a real thing until, they had to bring me back to be arraigned in Tampa, Florida, which my case was out of, and I lived in Vegas. So, you go on this plane, it's basically looks like an unmarked Southwest Airlines aircraft, and, everything's stripped out, and then everyone is shackled. Your hands are shackled to your waist, and your feet are shackled. And then you're walking on the plane, you're seeing people in different levels of the federal system. And this plane was stopping in Colorado at ADMAX. And ADMAX is where the Timothy McVeighs of the world are and things like that. The kind of people that, they're so dangerous that they put them underneath the concrete on the floor. So you can't even see the jail is underground. So, when you're going on a plane, you're seeing people, we're going to make the stop at ADMAX to drop people off. You're seeing guys that have face masks, you're seeing guys that you can tell that, they've been in the system for a very, very, very long time. That was probably the first time where I started seeing, what was actually wrong with the criminal justice system, where instead of reserving prisons and jails for people that we're afraid of, we're putting a lot of people in prison and jails, the people that we're just mad at or annoyed at. And that's what makes up the bulk of the population.
Like there's one guy, 21-year-old guy, who was there for robbery.
Right.
He left the cell, I guess.
Yeah. He left to go get sentenced and he came back. He had a 40-year sentence and I physically saw him age from the time that morning and the time that evening. I physically saw him age in his face, just the amount of stress of just a 21-year-old trying to wrap the concept of going to prison for 40 or plus years, whatever the number was.
And what was your sentence?
My sentence was 51 months. I mean, I think generally speaking, I actually got off pretty easy. The average sentence in federal prison is about 10 years. And because I didn't have a prior record, The judge gave me half the time, which she split it in half at 51 months.
51 months, roughly 4 years.
Right, right. A little over 4 years plus another additional 6 months at the halfway house.
I did 4 years of college. I hated it. I really, to this day, I still resent it. 4 years in prison must have been so much worse.
Yeah, you at the moment, you really can't fathom. You can't fathom, you know, how am I going to be living in a box for the next 4 years? Like, there's no way to prepare for it. There's no way to wrap your brain around what that feels like. And you, what was interesting is the human's ability to adjust to under whatever circumstances you put in. And that's the first time I really experienced that at a real, real level. And you know, you get a concept of when it comes to time management, where you learn to live in the present. You're not living in the future because you don't know what the future is going to hold. You don't know if you're actually going to be able to safely even leave prison. You know, there's people that I've seen in prison commit suicide. It was the people that I've seen in prison that was seriously injured or killed. So you really don't know what this looks like. Every day is, you know, you're just, you know, basically praying and hoping to get to the next day and taking every day at a time. So, you know, you can't wrap your brain around what that's like. And, you know, you just learn to live in the present.
How do you do that? How do you get your mind to not think about all the potential eventualities?
Yeah, you know, one of the things that I learned personally was you learn to focus on the things that you have control over and not put any energy in the things that you don't have control over. I think that's probably the first lesson that anyone that's in a situation like that learns, because especially when you're highly entrepreneurial and, you know, you're doing what I was doing, you're used to being in control of a lot of things. You're used to controlling, you know, where you go, when you go. You're not really bound by a 9-to-5, so to speak. So, you know, it's nothing to pick up and go here and do that. And then you also, of course, you have the income to support that as well. So you're used to being controlled, used to being able to somewhat be able to control your fate. When you go into institution, you know, you have control over very little. You don't have control over when you wake up. You don't have control over when you go to sleep. You don't have control over what you eat. When you eat, you have control over nothing, right? You don't even have control over when the lights turn on and off. So, you know, going through that situation, you learn really to really focus on yourself. You know, but I do have control over. I have control over my thoughts. I have control over my energy. I have control over my internal workings of, you know, am I going to be positive? Am I going to be negative? I have control over what books I consume, what books I choose not to consume, and, you know, things like that. And then you learn that actually that learning that self inner control is actually more powerful than controlling all the external things that you used to control prior to.
Did you have a technique for controlling your thoughts, for getting them on the things that are actually helpful and not for all the things that you can't control and what actually make the time tougher?
Yeah, I think I learned to be deliberate. I learned to be very deliberate on what I did pay attention to. So one way was the books. I would read a lot of books. I would read books that really were books that would basically roadmaps to where I wanted to go. I wasn't quite there, so I read a lot of business books. You know,
some of the books?
From Good to Great was a good one. Jim Collins, and there was I read. The name just escapes me at the moment. Mm-hmm. But it was just really a lot of books, whatever I can come across, you know, magazines, Fast Company, just other people building businesses, entrepreneur magazines.
Was there a kind of book that you were into? Because Good to Great is it feels like a book about how big companies can be led better. Right. And there's some takeaways for smaller companies, but it feels like it's meant for Fortune 500 companies. Is that the direction you went in?
Interesting enough, those are the books that were available, right? So, you know, but, you know, it was about, you know, how large companies went could be better. And for me, I tried to boil that down to if I was going to learn something from what these big companies did, you know, if I was going to start something, what would I do? And, you know, some of those principles, you know, I actually took with me, and I found that there were things that were relatable that, you know, that was just to me that seemed like timeless principle, regardless of what stage a company we're in.
Is there one that especially that you hold true too?
Yeah, I think one of them is, you know, versus telling time versus, you know, building clocker versus being a time teller. I think that was one that stood out to me. And I always try to pay attention to when we're thinking about, you know, how we're going to build our product roadmap or what we're going to offer. And, you know, especially when we're looking to get product market fit on something, you know, where is it really heading, and where do we want to fit in that story, you know, as far as our company. And I think in a lot of ways for our business, because we didn't really have a lot of businesses to look at or compare ourselves to, we had the ability to really set the tone and really set the tone of the market.
I also remember that NPR piece that I told you about before we started that was just amazing. We talked about how you learned about spreadsheets. Yeah, can you talk about that?
Yeah, so you don't have access to a computer. So, you know, one of the ways that, you know, I would spend a lot of time with guys who had white collar crime. So these were guys who were either corporate attorneys or CEOs of even some large companies, you know, that had different prison sentences for various white collar crimes. And then you would ask them, you would become basically a student to them. And, you know, they would teach you basically how to do spreadsheets, how to create business models. You know, what are the important components of a business plan or business process? And, you know, we would spend a lot of time talking to them. And then it would get to the point where, you know, you would want to put in practice what you would see or what you would learn. And, you know, that required, you know, of course, you know, working spreadsheets. So because we didn't have a computer, you would get, you know, you would take pieces of computer paper together, and you would get a ruler, and you would draw all your lines, and you would make your spreadsheets. You would do it all by hand, and you had the time, you had the energy, but, you know, it was those exercises, which was a lot of mental exercise, just gives you an escape, and it gives you a way to basically place your mind. You know, I would go through my mind the steps from buying the first piece of equipment to hiring my first employee to having my first sale. And I would go through all this in my mind as if it was a movie playing out in my mind. And, you know, and that was what I used to spend my time doing.
What are some of the ideas that you had for businesses that you discarded? You obviously picked one. What are some of the ones that you didn't go with?
There was one for real estate that I looked at that I thought might have been interesting to you know, think of ways to be able to make a different process for buying and selling houses. There was another one that was around event promotions. There was one around advertising, actually, interesting enough, because I didn't have the concept of the sheer mass of Facebook and all the rest of those companies that kind of have those things on, like, you know, I was even brainstorming an idea of, you know, coming out with a cell phone service that was completely supported by advertising, not have a concept of how capital intensive that would be or what that would look like, just a random thing. Things like that. I didn't really restrict myself. I would think of things large or small as if there was no barriers of finances or anything, and I would just go through the mental exercise of what would this business look like if I was going to do it.
All right, I want to get into how you discovered this idea, what the pain was. But first, let me talk about my sponsor. It's called Acuity Scheduling. Do you know these guys?
No, I have not.
All right, you got to find out about them. Here's what they do. They make it easy for people to book, they make it easy for people to get others to schedule meetings with them. So I'll tell you a story about one of my past interviewees, a guy named Colin Stewart. He heard that if you want to build great software, you should talk to your customers. Well, he had no customers, so he decided he was going to talk to the kinds of people that he wanted as customers. And he really didn't know how to get a hold of them, so he said, I have a LinkedIn account, I have a Facebook account. I'm just going to start messaging every single person that I think is a good fit on Facebook and LinkedIn. And he just would sit there, open a ton of tabs, send out messages to these people saying, please, can I get on a call with you so I can understand your business, because I'm trying to create software for businesses like yours. And he did this so much that he actually got kicked off of just about every network. And these days, you can't get kicked off forever because it's just such a critical part of people's lives. So he was able to get back on, but it gives you a sense of how many people he was reaching out to. Now, the problem with doing something like that is that you can't say to every one of them, can I talk to you a Thursday at 5 p.m.? Or can I talk to you and then say, hey, what works for you, and have them all try to respond back with times? They're not going to respond back with times. You have to make it easy for them to actually accept a call. And that's where software that I'm here to talk about, Acuity Scheduling, comes in. With Acuity Scheduling, you sign up, you go to their site, you connect your calendar to them, so Acuity knows when you're busy, when you're not. You select the times that you're available to have phone calls, or if you want, you could even use it for in-person meetings. For example, I always pick Thursdays. I could also sometimes, if I have a Friday off, I might just go in and say, all this Friday, I'm available for calls. And then it gives you a link that you send out to hundreds of people, thousands of people, even 10 people. And all they have to do is, if they want to schedule a call with you, click the link and then pick a time that's convenient for them when you are also available to have that meeting. And as soon as they do, that time is blocked off to everyone else. And there are tons of other cool features, like you can say, what's your phone number, of course, so it makes it easy to connect. You might ask them a question or two, like, what's your business? I like to ask people, what's your Skype name? And then you have all that ready to go. As soon as they do that, all that information is on your calendar at the exact date, so you never forget to have that call. And it's also on their calendar, so they never forget. And they could get reminders by email, they could get text messaging, that whole thing happens automatically. And if you want, it connects with tons of other software, so when someone books with you, you can even add them to your address book, you can add them to your email mailing list, whatever it is that you want. Great software. Anyone who hasn't tried it should go try it. It's good for phone meetings, it's good for presentations, it's good for in-person meetings. Anything you want, go to AcuityScheduling.com. And if you add a /Mixergy at the end, they're going to give you 45 days free to try it so you can see the results when you use their link. Go to AcuityScheduling.com/Mixergy. Let me say it again because my voice is still hoarse from being sick from recovering. So I want to be clear. It's AcuityScheduling.com/Mixergy. And I'm grateful to them for sponsoring. Excuse me. So the idea for Pigeonly came from where? What was the problem that you saw?
Yeah. So once I was, once you get settled in, you start, you know, adjusting to the environment that you're in. I just started noticing that, you know, there was a huge problem that I didn't previously know existed, where it was really difficult for people to connect and communicate with their lovers on the outside. It was either too expensive or it was too inconvenient for people who lived in a digital world to communicate with people who lived completely in the analog world. So that's when the idea started, where I just wanted, you know, at the time, just wanted to build a simple product that will allow people to easily send printed photos on the outside and have those photos printed and mailed to their loved ones on the inside. And that was it. So we started out, building out, you know, that first product when I was released.
Let me get clear on it. What was the first product?
So the first product was what's now called Pigeonly Photos.
So it was just saying, how do I get photos to people who are in prison? How did you know that that was a need? How did you know that they couldn't just print it out and send it out?
It was just from my own personal experience. You know, I saw that, you know, the only way at the time in order to send photos were to go to the FedEx or CVS or Walgreens, have the photos printed out, and then go to a post office and mail it. And it was really time-consuming process that people just wouldn't do it because they first had to figure out how to get it off their digital media and then get it printed and then go to a post office and mail it.
You know what? I've been dying to print out some photos for myself and my wife. Just like to remind her of something or to do something sweet. And it's such a pain. I have a photo printer at home. I can't get it to work. I want to go to CVS and kind of make a day of it with my son or an evening with it. Let's just go over to the CVS. You'll see it get printed. It'll be fun. It's such a pain.
Yeah.
it's a drag. I get it. And I imagine that for them, it's even harder. But a lot of times when people talk about that service, Frederick, they compare it to a couple of other services that already do it. So didn't this already exist and all people had to do is just change the address to the prison that their loved ones in?
Yeah, so you have services like Shutterfly or Snapfish that, you know, do the same thing. But there's different nuances that work for this that those services don't account for. One of them mainly being the packaging material. So institutions are very specific about the type of packaging material that they allow. And Shutterfly and Snapfish don't really accommodate for that. So one of the things that we did was, you know, we made sure that our packaging would also be approved at the institution. And it's also nuances like the number of photos you put in an envelope. That's something that, you know, rules change from facility to facility that also those services don't account for.
And you have to know from facility to facility what the limitations are?
Right. Each facility has their own rules, and our system, we bake in all those rules so that from the user side, their experience, they can upload 100 photos. We'll break it down to the right amount of envelopes that matches for whatever facility they're sending it to.
Oh, wow. I see. All right. So let me ask you this. When I started Mixergy, I thought, great, the startup audience is my world. That's what I've always lived in. I'll build a business here. And then what I kept hearing from people was startups don't really have money.
Right.
Right. And I said, no, that's not true. And then I discovered, of course, it is true. Right. They're hustling. They're saving every dollar. They're sleeping in their office if they can to avoid paying rent or working out of their home or sleeping out of boxes. Literally, there was one guy slept out of a car outside of a Taco Bell who's a Mixergy fan. Did you have any concern about prisoners not having the money to really become a market for you?
Yeah, so inmates themselves are not our customers. So our customer is the family members and their friends. So their support network on the outside. The inmates benefit from the service because they receive the photos, but the real customer, the person, our customer, the person that's paying for it, is the family member. So when I looked at the market, you know, that was one of the first questions is, you know, well, how many people are out there that really would make up this market? So when we started doing the math, we found that, you know, people that actually have a loved one or someone that they're socially connected to that's in prison, is about 16 to 20 million people in the U.S. And what we found was, you know, if we can offer this product and have it faster, more convenient and higher quality and be cheaper than what it costs for you to go do it yourself. Then we knew we would have a recipe that would win, and that's what we were able to build.
I see. And you weren't doing the calculations on how big this market is compared to another one. You said, I know the space. I know there's a problem. No one else is doing this. Right. I could do it.
Right.
But in order to do it, you still have to figure out what you still have to figure out the facilities limitations. You have to understand all that stuff. How did you do that?
Yeah, it was just collecting data. So our process is, so first we built the product. So we built the first version of the product while I was in a halfway house. We posted a job on Freelancer.
At a halfway house you did this?
Yeah. So okay. We built the first version. Version one, the MVP, was while we was at the halfway house. Then when we was ready to market it, you know, I made the assumption that because I knew that all criminal records is public record, that I could just do a Google search and identify everyone who's in jail so that I can be able to send them marketing material and say, hey, if you're interested in getting photos, here's a new way. What we found was that that didn't really exist. Although all these records are public data, there was no single space where you can go and download or get a copy of, you know, a list, if you will, of everyone who is currently in prison. So we end up building the first nationwide inmate database that exists that we call Haystack. And basically what Haystack does is it's scraping all the public records from court documents to prison facility records to know where everyone is located, and we save them in our database. With that information, we are basically targeting direct mail to inmates, let them know, hey, this is a new service that we have. You can let your family member know, and then they can sign up.
Did the product come first, or did Haystack come first?
The product came first.
The product
Haystack
came first.
Was born out of our problem when we had a marketing problem. That's how.
So then, how did you build the product? The ability to print at mass scale and to ship is not easy, is it? Was there a service that offered it that you were able to tie into?
So, you know, when we first started, I made the assumption that we could just go buy a printer out of Best Buy and do it ourselves. And I quickly learned that that didn't make sense. So we actually was able to find a fulfillment company in California that's what their business was, that they did fulfillment for Shutterfly, they did fulfillment for Walgreens, and that's part of their business line was, you know, the printing and shipping of photos. And we integrated into their system, and then, they did all our photo fulfillment.
I see. So that part was easily solved.
Right.
How about getting the part where someone uploads their photos and has a smooth process for sending it over? What'd you do for that?
Yeah, so that was what we outsourced to get our first version with me, to get our first product built. And that was a work in progress. We had a lot of learning curve to get that right as far as the user experience. And that was my first learning lesson on how to build a website and how to build, you know, something that is actually usable.
Where'd you find the developer?
We found them on freelancer.com, actually.
So you went to freelancer.com, you posted a help wanted ad, and you ended up with a developer who was going to do this for you.
Yep.
And did you create the mock-ups? Did you know how to draw it out and tell them, here's what I want?
So what the first person we hired before we hired the developers, we hired somebody to write functional specs. So what I was looking for was someone that I could just talk plain English and say, hey, this is what I need. This is how I need it to work. And then they converted that into actual specs that we gave to the developer to build.
And again, you got that from Freelancer.
Yep.
I see. How'd you know to do that? Most people don't.
Yeah, I didn't know. I didn't really know what I was doing at that moment. All I knew is that I needed a set of instructions that I can give to a programmer. So I made the assumption that because I don't have a computer science background, I don't know how to program myself. I've made the assumption that I needed an intermediary, someone between me and a developer to articulate what I was trying to get done. And then that's when I started searching that's when I came across functional specs. I said, okay, well, this looks like what I need. And then I said, well, I'm going to post a job for functional specs. And then there was a woman that responded based out of Houston, Texas. And, you know, I explained to her how it worked. We spent a lot of time on the phone. And then she actually created the specs for me.
And it was pretty smooth with her. But with the actual developer, you had some issues. What are the issues?
Yeah, so the first issues was that overall we just didn't really get part of the issue when you're building your first product, you don't really think of everything. So even when you think you've thought of everything, you haven't thought of half of everything. So, you know, our first version was very buggy. It didn't perform the way we thought it performed. So we end up having to scrap it, the whole thing, and then end up the same lady who wrote the specs end up coding it herself.
So, oh, really?
Yeah.
So I also heard that you had an issue where the developer disappeared on you, and then yes. There was extra costs involved. It was like all that stuff that goes along with hiring.
It was a typical outsourced contract. You know, you really don't know what you're going to get. So, you know, if I had to do it all again now, I would spend the time getting all the front end and the UI stuff done, and then be able to give someone an exact blueprint word for word. Here's where the button is. When you click it, it does this. You know, I would do that way if I had to do it again.
What did it cost you to have her build it out?
I think our total investment was right around, I don't know, maybe $5,000 probably.
And that includes even Haystack?
No, that did not include Haystack. Haystack was probably like another $5,000. At that moment, we didn't have as many states integrated as we do now. So today we have all 50 states. Then we only had one.
How'd you get the money?
So it was all from friends and family. So I reached out to all people that I knew, and we was raising $500 at a time, $1,000 at a time. And, you know, I said, you know, this is what we're trying to build. You know, here's we are in the process. And, you know, the very first money came from Alfonso, my co-founder. He used some of his student loan money. And we basically, you know, that's how we very first started. And
Alfonso then Brooks.
Alfonso Brooks. And then after we got that going, by the time we started talking to other friends and family, we had already started doing stuff. So they were seeing that things were getting done, and people believed in us.
And they got a share of the business?
Yeah, so we did all convertible notes.
How'd you know to do convertible notes with them?
I didn't.
You did it after the fact.
Yeah, after the fact.
You just said, I'll give you a share of the business. Right. It wasn't specified how?
No, it wasn't specified. It was just all based on trust. Yes. So what we did was, you know, once we got into the accelerator months later, the NUMMI accelerator, and we started learning the proper legal structures, the Delaware C Corps, all those things that's necessary to go raise funding, we went back and we was able to clean everything up.
Okay, and everybody was cooperative. Nobody said no.
Yeah, everybody was cool.
Right. And frankly, now they end up with a really good piece of an incredible company.
Right.
The kind of deal that Y Combinator partners would kill for, I think.
Right.
So then you had your product. The next thing that you did was marketing. And this is the thing that Steven told me when I met him, the guy who works at Pigeonly. That just blew my mind. Talk about the marketing that you did with direct mail.
Yeah. So once we built Haystack, we now said we solved our marketing problem. Now we knew where people were, and we knew their address, we knew their name, and we knew their contact information. So then we started sending out greeting cards directly to them, telling them about the product and service. So basically, hey, you know, here's a new way that you can get photos. It'd be way more easier for your family, and it's going to save you a bunch of money, or save your family a bunch of money. And we saw a 25% response rate to our direct mail. Now, at the time, I didn't know average direct mail response rates was 1% and 2% if you was lucky. You know, I just thought, you know, I was actually a little bit disappointed. I was like, you know, we only got this many people. So,
I should underline that. You said 25% response rate. That means that 25% of the people who got the mail, and it was 10,000 pieces that you sent out, right?
Right.
That means 25% of them, 2,500, ended up doing what? Buying?
You're going to our website and sending an order. Yes, paying.
Whoa, I see. And actually paying. And right now, I think what you do is free photos plus shipping. Am I right?
Right. So we don't charge per print. You only pay for shipping.
And back then, did you do the same thing?
Back then, it was the reverse. We paid 50 cents a print, and shipping was included.
Okay. Why'd you switch?
So then it was a technical limitation. So then we didn't have the ability to, the app wasn't designed to be able to charge for shipping and print separately. So now that, of course, we have everything in-house, we can design stuff better. We can play with the toggles of, are we going to charge for prints, or are we going to charge for shipping, or are we going to charge for both? So we actually, for some institutions where we don't have a lot of traction, we will turn off the charge for prints, and then institutions where we do have traction, we will charge for prints. So we actually use it for marketing. Some places where we need to, it'll be free, but other places where we have a lot of traction, you know, they'll pay the regular price.
Who wrote the piece, the mail piece that got 25% response?
That was the first, the same contractor, Sabina, who did our functional specs. She wrote the first version.
Really? Is she still working with you guys?
No. So when we moved to, we moved the company to Vegas, she didn't want to make the move from Texas when we all moved together. So she has, you know, still part of the equity in the company, but, you know, she decided to move.
I asked Steven why you got a 25% response rate. He said, they don't get that much mail. They actually want to get it. Am I right?
Yeah, yeah. That was a big thing that, you know, a lot of times people would receive our mail and it was just such a big deal, which I already knew just from my own personal experience. It's a really big deal when your name is called at mail call for mail. And, you know, it's one of those things where you pay attention to it. So it's not like here or when you're out and you get all these junk mails, you don't pay attention to it. You actually pay attention to what you see.
Okay. So now you actually had customers, you had real revenue. Do you remember the revenue after that first piece of mail that you sent out?
I think we did a couple $100s. It wasn't a whole lot. It was a little, but it was starting from zero. So it was very exciting for us. It was enough for us to pay our cell phone bills. We were ecstatic. And it kept growing. So what happened, you know, the word would spread. But before we can do another mailer, friends would tell other friends, people would tell other people. And, you know, we had more people send orders.
I see. Did you cover your cost? Because it doesn't sound like if you only had a couple $100s that you made back the $10,000, the money that it cost.
No, not at the time, but over time it did. So it didn't. The very first response, it didn't. But over time, when those people come back and send more orders, it did.
Okay. All right. I want to find out how you got funding and then how you developed the next products. And why don't we get to just revenue real quick? Where are you now with revenue?
So right now we're doing a little over $150,000 a month in revenue.
$150,000 a month in revenue. Wow. All right, let's talk about my sponsor, and then I'll come back into this and hear how you grew to this point. My sponsor is a company called TopTal. Do you know them?
No, I don't.
That's why they're sponsoring. My guess is that they really want as many of my interviewees to hear about them as possible, and if the audience hears, then it's gravy. TopTal is a network of really top developers. We're talking about the kinds of people who would go to work for Google ordinarily. That's the level that they want. And they pride themselves on having a really rigorous screening process. They've been called the Ivy Leagues of developers. And once they have that network of developers, when an entrepreneur or a project manager or someone needs to hire developers, they call up TopTal. They let them know what their issues are, what they're trying to build, how they work. And then TopTal has a matchmaker, like a real matchmaker at the company, who goes and finds the right person in their network, makes the connection and says, here, is this the right fit? And if it is, you can often get started within days and just keep going. And you could work with them part-time, full-time, project basis. You can get a team of people all at once. And I saw some of the back end. Like if there's someone who's working for your iOS app, for example, if they have an issue, they now have this other network of top developers that they can go on Slack and start saying, hey, here's the issue I've got. Get a lot of feedback on. They're a phenomenal company. What's great about them is that the developers can actually think through the problem in a way that you as the entrepreneur may not be able to because you don't know the code. So, excuse me. Anyone who's interested in checking them out, and many people in my audience have, anyone else who wants to go should go to toptal.com/Mixergy. When you go there, they're giving Mixergy listeners 80 hours of TopTal developer credit when they pay for their first 80 hours. That's an extra 80 hours of developer credit. In addition, they've got a no-risk trial period of up to 2 weeks. I've never seen anyone offer that. Have you ever hired a developer who says, you know what, if it doesn't work out, 2 weeks, don't pay me anything?
No. All right. Right.
And you get started not when they quit their job and then finally get some space and then come back to work for you. They'll start within a couple of days. They're ready to roll. All right. I'm really grateful to TopTal for sponsoring. And frankly, if anyone out there wants an intro to my guy over at TopTal, just email me, andrew@mixergy.com. I've got such a close relationship with them now because I've sent so many of my audience members to them that I'd be happy to make an introduction to anyone who wants it. TopTal.com/Mixergy. Grateful to them for sponsoring. What happened next, Frederick? At that point, is that when Y Combinator and the funding came in, or did you go for another product first?
So we actually, we had the photo printing product, and then I learned what a technology accelerator was, and we reached out to, I saw a CNN special, Black in America, and was talking about Silicon Valley, the new promised land. And then I learned about the New Me Accelerator. So I was like, oh, wow, this is interesting. And so I just started applying to every accelerator I can find, from so Techstars to Black Combinator to New Me. And New Me was the accelerator that accepted us. So we went out to San Francisco, my co-founder and I, and we did the program. And at the end of the 12-week program, we raised our first $1 million funding round. And then we were able to basically, you know, start building a business at that point. And that's when we added our second product, which is our voice over IP product. Basically, what this does is that it allows people to save money on their expensive prison phone calls. So you have some cases where prison phone calls can be as high as $15 for 15 minutes. Our service will allow them to be able to get their costs down. So, for example, in federal prison, you pay upwards of about $69 or $70 for 300 minutes. With our product, that cost drops down to about $18 for those same 300 minutes. And 300 is the marker, because that's the max of minutes that you can use in federal prison. And most people use their whole 300 minutes. So those are the price difference. So our system basically, because we have the data to know, once again, using Haystack, we have the data to know where people are. Our system will automatically generate local numbers for people based on their location. So, for example, if you have a loved one in San Quentin, our system will give you a San Quentin telephone number that forwards to your existing Atlanta, Georgia telephone number. So when he calls home, he'll call you. Instead of calling your direct line, he'll call the San Quentin telephone number that forwards to you.
Oh, now I get it. For some reason, it just clicked as you said it. Because they still have to pay for that local call, right?
Right.
It's the
right.
long distance call where right. the real ripoff comes in, and now they don't have to pay the long distance call. What's the price difference when they have to pay for a local call versus a long distance call?
Yeah, so that same local call costs about 90 cents. So it's substantially cheaper.
90 cents for how long?
No, for 15 minutes. So it's about
15 minutes,
cents a
minute. I see. So that's way more reasonable. That's more reasonable than a payphone here. I see. And now all they have is that local call, and they don't have to pay themselves. It's their loved one who pays, the person who's receiving the call.
Exactly.
You know what? I completely brushed over New Me. What is New Me?
So New Me is a technology accelerator that focuses on underrepresented minorities when it comes to people trying to get technology. So this is women, Hispanics, African-Americans, et cetera. Just people that you typically don't see that are building startups, or people that you typically don't see that don't have a network in San Francisco, people that are live in different places, can't necessarily pick up and move. And, you know, Angela Benton, the CEO and founder, she's done a huge job. She was probably the reason how we were able to get started, because we didn't have any network, we didn't have any connections, and we wouldn't have been able to be introduced to the investors that we introduced to, you know, once we finished the program.
What did they give you, and what share of the business did they expect in return?
Yeah, so the model then was 4%, and it was basically just a note or a warrant, I guess, is how it was set up. And they, what they do is that they work with you to work with you on your model. They basically spend a lot of time helping you prepare your deck and your pitches, helping you think through your business model, make sure you think of all the aspects of, you know, basically help you understand what they expect, investors are expected to see, what type of traction do you need. Design help.
What's one thing that they gave you specifically that helped your business?
I think for us, the biggest thing that helped us was understanding how to position and basically focus on what was really important in our business. So that's when I learned that we really should focus on the database, which actually today is about 80% of what we do. And then the products is how we monetize the data that we collect. So that was probably the biggest turning point for us.
You got into, I guess greeting cards weren't next. It was the phone service that was next. Same model for getting new customers?
Yeah, same model. We also had the added benefit of being able to leverage all of our photo customers and let them know about the phone service.
How'd you let them know?
So we basically would cross market. So if you would send a photo, on the receipt for the photo, we would print an ad for the voice product and let them know, hey, you know, if you're interested in phone service, you can use this phone service, and here's a call to action. And then that's how we created that.
Okay. What about the greeting cards that I saw on the site?
Yeah, so those are coming soon. So those are the things we're working on now. Right now, what we have in development is our messaging product. We'll allow people to send letters and messages either digitally or through the mail. So if the institution has digital communication like email, it'll send it digitally. And if not, it'll send it through the mail. And then after that, postcards and greeting cards.
So some inmates don't have the ability to get email.
Yes. So there's some institutions, particularly in federal, will allow you to receive basically a closed email. So it's not email as you and I know it, but it's basically digital messaging that, you know, you don't, it just doesn't allow you to do images or anything like that, but just text messaging back and forth.
What about the product that lets people send articles?
Yeah, so we're excited about that. That's in development. That's part of the messaging app. But what the idea would be that, you know, one of the big demands is people always call home and they say, hey, you know, can you send me some information about this or some information about that? So what we want to do is make it easy for the family member to be able to print out documents as they would print out at home and then have it sent to their loved one. But we do the printing and mailing.
Oh, I see. Right. So it's not just, hey, I came across this article that I thought you'd find interesting. You're specifically concerned with this one issue, but you don't have access to updated information on it.
Right.
I'll send it over to you, and here's an easy way for me to do it.
Right.
Okay. And the reason I asked about the greeting cards first is I see here in the producer notes, our producer said that you said, we sent 1,000 greeting cards to inmates, and I wrote the copy, told them someone wants to send you some photos. Go to this website, and you got 2,000 signups. What was that?
Yes. So that was how we was marketing the photo product. So that's what we was using for the direct mail.
Just sending them greeting cards.
Yeah. So we would produce our own greeting cards and send it to them, and they would get a nice greeting card, nice motivation message, and then it would then tell them, hey, you know, here's how you can get some photos if you're interested.
I see. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. That's a huge response, and you wrote that yourself. You came up with that marketing.
Yeah.
Then the other thing that you said that helped grow was the UI change.
Yeah, we've made so much. I've learned so much about user experience, user interface. We've spent so much time optimizing it, basically from what we've been learning. We've probably, I can't even count the amount of changes we've made to it. But it's just, it makes such a big difference. Just because of our user base, they're not super tech savvy. So we have to really work to simplify things and make things as easy as possible. Even things that we're constantly making decisions when it comes to user experience of even when, you know, how much information do we want to show? How much does the information does the customer need to move to the next step? And we're doing those give and takes to try to give the best possible experience. So we've seen changes that we've made that, you know, can change the needle from, you know, 20% and 30% on the amount of photos being sent from just changing things.
Which one? I kind of see one here, but to be honest, I don't understand what the producer wrote. Said something like, we put search the inmate first and then allowed them to upload photos. They completed the process, and when the steps were reversed, they were much less likely to complete the process.
Yeah. So one of the big changes that we've made is that we used to allow you to upload photos, and then you would use the search function to find your inmate and find out his address and all that information. We realized that a lot of people was falling off because they was either uploading their photos and then getting discouraged, not being able to find their inmate at step two. So we reversed it, and we made all of our products inmate-centric. What we mean by that, or context-centric, I guess is a better way to say that, is that the first thing you do after you create an account is you find your contact. Who's the person that you're trying to connect with? Once you connect with your contact, then we give you options to communicate with them. So you can choose to send a photo, you can choose to use the phone, whatever you want to do, you can choose after that. And then that significantly changed the amount of successful
Why do you think?
I think it's mainly tied to just the way people's brains work. When they show up at our website and our user base in particular, they're thinking about an individual. That's what they're thinking about. They're not really thinking about a photo. They're not thinking about a letter. They're not thinking about a phone call. They're thinking about John. That's my son, or that's my brother or sister, whoever.
Right.
And that's who I'm thinking about. So the first thing I want to do is I want to find John. Once I find John, then I'll think about, you know, how do I want to communicate with John? How do I want to maintain that relationship and that contact with John? So we've made it very personal. We've made it very, very focused around the individual. And then our goal is to bring that person as close to you as possible so that you can interact with him the same way or as close as you can to everybody else in your contact list. Just like how you use your phone.
Right,
you make
right.
Phone call, go to your contact list first, and then you do whatever your next action is.
Plus, on my phone, I know I'm going to be able to find my brother if I want to send him a text message, right? So
right.
If it happened to come afterwards, even if it was a little clunky, I'd be confident that he was there.
Right.
In this context, I wouldn't necessarily know that I could find the...
Right,
the person
exactly.
I'm looking for, or you could find them, or you even understand what I'm doing.
Right.
Right.
Exactly.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. Who does your UI experiments?
So we have a guy we was able to recruit, Peter Vogt from Texas, and he's been a huge asset. He's came in and, you know, he's kind of turned everything upside down, and he has our stuff really dialed in.
Okay. One of the big challenges you told our producers that you have to build everything from scratch.
Yeah.
What do you mean? How's that different from other entrepreneurs who have to build everything from scratch?
Yeah. So I think one of the main differences is for us is that a lot of times we can't just pull a platform or API off the shelf that does what we need to do. So we would have to build things that if we were just going to build a phone product for the general public, we could probably just use a Twilio API or the Plevo API and be done. But because we're building it for our user base, we have to go a step further and we have to build the tool before we can use any other tool.
I see.
So we just have a lot of that. Just because there hasn't been a lot of tools built to interface with this demographic. Had there been, then, you know, I mean, I guess now we're inadvertently building that tool to interface with this market that other people can use us. But, you know, we're the first one. So
is that where it's eventually going?
Yeah, I definitely would like to see us move towards a platform and for us to be able to allow people to leverage all the data that we're collecting. Just because, I don't expect us to be able to build every product that's possible. And, you know, I think that, you know, a lot of benefit can be brought to the market if other people might have creative ideas and they can leverage our data and build on top of it.
By the way, the name Pigeonly, I misspell it. Does that happen with your users too?
So what's funny is that we don't, majority of our website, we just recently started putting time to building up our online presence. Prior to, all of our website was direct traffic. All of our traffic is direct traffic, and it's because it's coming from the inside out. So what we give on the inside is all call actions are all SMS based. So we'll tell the inmate, hey, have your loved one text phone to this telephone number, and then we'll respond with that text message with the link, and they just click the link.
I see. So they don't even have to type it in.
No. But people know our name now. People know our names now. People know, they even know the names of our products before, you know, PhotoPigeon, the old names that we don't use anymore. And it all points to us. So people, you know, people can easily find us now. And now we're starting to have an online presence. But for the first 2-3 years, it was 100% all from inside out. So it was all direct traffic straight to us.
Do you guys have Pigeonly.com too?
Yes, we do.
You do. Okay. All right. That helps. Your mom, we asked you about what was a moment of great satisfaction, the time you celebrated, and had something to do with the New York Times. What was this New York Times article that you're...
Yeah, it was right when we finished the accelerator. The New York Times wrote an article about my story, and it was funny because the very first time, I was in a newspaper, it was my indictment. So that just broke my mom's heart. So for the next time for me to be a paper, for it to be something so positive, and for me to be recognized for basically turning something around and building something that is benefiting so many people, it was a big moment for both of us.
You know what? Actually, a typo on your name, pigeonly.com, leads to a competitor of yours.
Really?
Yes, I think so. Do you know Inmate Aid?
Yes.
Right? So it looks like they bought a typo on your domain.
Interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I'm going to pull that up.
Here, I'll send it to you. I'll send you the typo in my chat box.
Please. That's interesting.
What's the best part for you day to day?
I think the best part for us is just knowing that we're making an impact with all the people that we're making an impact with, and just knowing how much, you know, we're helping folks that actually rely on our service. So, you know, when we see, like right now we're shipping, you know, about 5,000 photos a day. So, you know, seeing that kind of volume starting out where we just had a couple hundred in a day, to the amount of phone calls that we provide, you know, we do, you know, a little 2 million minutes a month. So just seeing, you know, that type of volume, just know that, you know, there's so many people all over the country that's relying on our service, you know, it's just really encouraging.
What about fans? I get the sense that you must have a lot of fans too, you personally.
I think I have a lot of supporters. I think it's mainly because I just represent to them that, you know, if I can do it, you can too. And you really just, it really just takes the idea and the willingness to actually put the work in, and you know, you can just build something. I always tell people to focus on building a solution to a problem, and it can actually go a long way.
It's such an inspiring story. I feel like at some point you're going to have an incredible career as a speaker, author, something, because I told you when I heard you on NPR, I got really excited. There's something that just makes life more exciting after hearing that. I think it's a sense of possibility. Like you said, if he could do it, I could do it. But it's more than that. It's he put in the time, and that's how he did it. There's something to, I'm not putting in enough time, I could do more. That's very inspiring, too.
Right.
And the highs that you reach, like Tony Hsieh now there as an advisor, if I heard right. Mitch Kapoor is there for you as an investor and advisor. So many other people that are now there with you, the kinds of people that they themselves have super fans.
Right, right.
Congratulations so much on building this up.
Thank you.
All right. The website for anyone who wants to check it out is pigeon.ly or pigeonly.com. Make sure to spell it right or else you end up on this other site that actually charges more.
Right.
And is the wrong site. And I really have got to thank Stephen for both being a fan of Mixergy and also making sure that I got this introduction, got to do this interview with you. And of course, my two sponsors are Top Tal, if you need to hire a great developer. And if you want people to actually schedule meetings with you in person on the phone, go to acuityscheduling.com. Or frankly, even if you want your team to be able to schedule calls and meetings better, acuityscheduling.com. Really good. Thank you so much. Thanks, Frederick.
Thank you.
Thanks. Bye, everyone.